With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best of motor racing.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Here we are again, the motorsport team, and we are casting the pod for April. This week, we do not have a guest, but we have the three wise men. Well, men, anyway. And we'll be looking back at the motor racing season so far. We've had three Grand Prix, we've had some World Rallies, and motor racing is underway. Spring is here. So, first of all, we are going to have a look at Grand Prix racing, and of course we are going to touch upon whether it's as exciting as it should be. I think the answer to that is probably no, but we'll find out in just a few moments. We'll be looking at the speed of the Red Bull, which is remarkable right now. Who do we think have been the best teams and drivers in these opening races? And do that some of the new teams deserve a place on the grid? We'll be looking at that as well. Okay, we'll start with our editor-in-chief, Nigel Roback. Nigel, you were in Bahrain, so you were able to have a good close look at things firsthand. Not a great start to the season.
It wasn't. It was... You know, I dare say it. I mean, it was one of the most tedious Grand Prix I've ever been to. I remember there was a race at Barcelona, I think in '98, which stands out in my mind as well, and does for quite a lot of people, as one of those afternoons, literally when nobody passed anybody. Mm. And Bahrain was a drag, no question about it. And we all left, you know, a little bit down, a little bit depressed, because this was the new format and everything else. But I must say, people were jumping up and saying, oh, well, we've got to get Bridgestone to make useless tyres, and, you know, we've got to have a fixed number of pit stops and all the rest of it. I don't want to see anything like that. I don't want to see any gimmicks at all in Formula One. I mean, I see Malia has been saying... been coming out with all sorts of fairground ideas. I think, you know, people who've been around this sport a little longer and have loved it all their lives probably feel Formula One should be purer than that.
Well, we've been bored before, haven't we?
Yeah, we've been bored before, absolutely. I mean, I've said to so many people, I was bored to tears by the sprint stop sprint era. I just thought it was like... I don't know. It was formulaic Grand Prix racing. I thought it was tedious, you know.
So you're not
beyond comparison.
Not a fan of Bernie's shortcut idea, then?
I think Bernie's shortcut. I still can't. I remember.
Should we perhaps? Explain Bernie's.
Well, Bernie came up with this idea that every circuit should have built into it a shortcut which a driver could use. I guess half a dozen times in a race, whatever, in order to enable him to get past the car in front of him, which is supposed to be the whole point of why we're there in the first place. But I noticed that, this is not something I often do, but I happened to see some rallycross on TV a couple of days ago, and it was at Lydon. In fact, it was on Bank Holiday Monday. And I noticed that in rallycross they've now adopted not a shortcut, but a long cut. So that on one lap you are required to take this longer way round.
More interesting.
Yeah, and fine. Great for rallycross. No problem with that. Don't want to see anything like that in Formula One. I mean, I was very much in favour of the ban on refuelling in the first place. And I still am. And I think, yes, Bahrain was dreadful. But everybody was feeling their way. Nobody had a clue how long the soft Bridgestones were going to last. everybody was ultra conservative. Then we, you know, Australia, I thought was a sensational race. And of course, the weather played a, you know, a huge part in that. As I said, you know, you as soon as you have wet or even damp, you have less grip. And as soon as you have less grip, you get overtaking because drivers make mistakes.
Yep.
And you can't guarantee rain at every race, of course, unless we have sprinklers. But again, it's a gimmick, isn't it? You cannot sort of stage a wet world championship just so that cars can actually pass each other. They're going to get rid of double diffusers at the end of this year. Finally, they should have got rid of them at the beginning of last year. You know, that should have been snuffed out at birth. But I think we just, I still think we have to give this format time. And I still think, even in Malaysia, right, it wasn't a great race, but it wasn't a bad race. And no, I didn't think it was. And there was evidence in, I thought there was evidence in Malaysia of drivers being aware of the fact they had to pass, or had to try to pass, because of the stupid rules. I mean, Lewis, look at Lewis. Lewis was sensational chopping up through the field.
Yeah, he was.
But of course, as soon as he came up on a vaguely comparably quick car, Sutil, there he stayed. So, you know, that can be improved by changing the rules, by getting rid of... I mean, I would get rid of diffusers altogether.
Hmm.
You know, I think they should have gone with the barge balls. But I'm not discouraged at all. I mean, Bahrain was awful, but I think the two races have made me feel a lot better about it.
Cause for optimism, Mr. Editor, yes?
Yep, I agree. I think we'll get some dull Grand Prix this year, as we always have done. You know, the Spanish Grand Prix, Hungarian Grand Prix, always ones that end up being processional generally, and that will be the same this year. Certainly, you know, the overtaking problem will be higher there than other circuits. But I agree with Nigel that Malaysia wasn't a bad race. The circuit's a good circuit for racing because it's wide. It's got, you know, it's got the hairpin bend. The first corner's good for overtaking.
Yep.
And we saw some good action there. So I think it was entertaining. And like Nigel, I guess we're slightly more purist in our way of thinking here. But it's a proper Grand Prix now. You have to look after your car over a Grand Prix distance. Look after your tyres. And it's not a sprint format race anymore, and I think that's bringing out a new interest for me watching races. And you can see the comparison of the way that someone like Lewis Hamilton goes about driving a Grand Prix and the way Jenson Button drives a Grand Prix over the course of the year. I think it's going to be very nip and tuck between them.
Mm.
Okay. Lewis, I think, has been fantastic this year in terms of what he's done on the circuit. He's been so entertaining to watch. And I think you know, if you used BBC's red button to watch one driver, it would be Lewis. But Jensen, again, you know, a classic Grand Prix victory, the way that he took his Australian win, you know, a dose of luck, but also courage of his convictions to make a judgment on tyres, come into the pits and stand by it, and then drive very well thereafter. So I think there's still lots of ingredients for a great season. But the remaining problem is still there and will be with us all year about overtaking. And it's all aero, as Nigel says. It's, you know, they need to sort the rules out to allow these cars to overtake.
Ed Foster, how have you enjoyed your season so far?
Yeah, but I think we might just say that noise in the background is not my stomach. It's a noisy radiator, if anyone's wondering. I think the season's been very good. Obviously, as Nigel said, that opening race in Bahrain was about as boring as it gets. But, you know, all these solutions that Nigel was mentioning, they're dealing with the problem and not the cause. And as Damien says, we've got to sort out the aero. But then the team's saying, oh, it's valuable advertising space and, you know, we don't want to get rid of the wings and all this kind of stuff. But the other day, Fernando Alonso came out and said, if you want to see overtaking, don't watch Formula One. You know, it's never going to be like MotoGP. And I think some people have got this sort of slightly hazy memory of there always being lots of overtaking in Formula One, which that there hasn't really. Certainly when you compare it to MotoGP. So I think everyone's got to take a slight step back. And appreciate sort of what it is, and it's not MotoGP, it's not touring cars, and it's I don't want to use the chess match like Max Mosley.
No,
but it's, you know, it's different.
I think that, you know, the point is that, you know, the overtaking, the Formula One overtaking should never be easy. It should never be, I mean, I'm thinking back now to the kart days when they had the Hanford wing. And go to a place like Michigan, and you could almost plot exactly where on which lap X would pass Y and Y would repass X. Yeah. And after it becomes meaningless.
Sure.
So it should never be easy, but it shouldn't be, it just shouldn't be impossible. As difficult as it is at the moment. No, exactly. You've got to be able to follow another car closely.
Talking of gimmicks, I rather like the gimmick of starting the Ferraris and the McLarens at the back of the grid after they fail to qualify. I think that's an excellent, an absolutely excellent gimmick.
Well, if we can ask them to carry on cocking up qualifying for the rest of the year, that would probably
be love to oblige.
Yes, I don't think that needs to go in the rules, really. Right.
Casual
request from motorsport.
I forgot to mention, guys, that of course this is, you are actually listening to a meeting of the Motorsport Magazine Overtaking Working Group. This is not an official body, but it's certainly going to be an important one, I feel. We haven't so far mentioned the S word, and I particularly want to because I find it particularly interesting. Now, bearing in mind that a lot of people around this table said that Michael Schumacher wouldn't come back to Formula One, and he did, the following discussion, you might want to bear that in mind. I'll quickly say what I think. I think it's been surprising, I must say, in the sense that I didn't think he'd come back and win everything, but I thought he'd come back and be more successful than he so far has been. Nigel, what do you think?
Yep, I would go along with that. I mean, of course, part of Michael's problem is, you know, his reputation precedes him, and you know, anybody else coming back, you know, would be given a longer period to settle in. But having said that, you know, when Lauda came back in 82, he won his third race. Started slowly in his first race. He was not really a factor.
Yeah.
Second race, much better. Third race, bang, right there. Well, those times were different. I know that. You know, technology has changed and everything else, and there's much more new stuff to absorb. Oddly enough, the thing that has not surprised me, again, this is maybe because I've always rated Nico Rosberg. That does not surprise me. I would have been very surprised if Michael had been out qualifying Nico. I really would. After 3 years away. You know, Ross... Nico was part of the Braun and then Mercedes plans a long time ago, and that's simply because Ross rates Nico so highly. So, he's had all these seasons at Williams with a, you know, not a strictly competitive car. But I have always thought there's a lot more to Rosberg than we've been able to see so far. So that doesn't surprise me. But I think in Malaysia, I think there were five Germans in the first eight on the grid, something like that. And Schumacher was the fifth. And I don't know how easily he's going to be coping with that.
Very easily.
I don't see the German papers, and I wouldn't be able to read them if I did. But I'd be interested to know what the attitude of the sort of the dailies is in Germany, because this is, you know, this is one of the country's gods.
Sure.
You know, one of the great, you know, one of the icons.
Absolutely.
I still can't believe that eventually, you know, he won't be, maybe not ever what he was, but, you know, close to it. It's still hard for me to believe that that won't happen eventually.
Damien, what's been your feeling about the Schumacher thing?
I'm prepared to give him time, because seven times world champion, whatever, coming back after 3 years at his age, with Formula One being what it is today, he was never going to come in and win races straight away. He's not as competitive as I would have expected, but I still think there are signs that he's getting there and that he will get there. The front tyres have been an issue for him. Narrower front tyres this year. He's struggled with those. He needs more time. There is a lack of testing these days, so he has, you know, he has to do it on race weekends. The expectation is clearly going to be there for him to start delivering soon, and his own expectations are going to be interesting. What I'm fascinated by is if he's enjoying it. If he's because he came back to enjoy himself because he missed the thrill of racing. Is he enjoying it? I don't know.
Well, I mean, Bahrain was the first race, but in Bahrain he did not look particularly as though he was enjoying it. I must say, when I saw him at the end of the first day, he looked almost sort of, I was going to say bewildered. He looked sort of shocked.
The problem with someone like Schumacher is that, and when he says he's coming back for the enjoyment of racing, what he really means is he's coming back for the enjoyment of winning. And having that competition, and someone as competitive as him isn't really going to be having as much fun as he could be unless he's on pole and winning the race. So I think that's certainly a factor. But also, I mean, the Mercedes GP car is certainly not the quickest on the grid, but I think there's also the way he sets his car up is quite sort of, it's very individual. It's quite different to how a lot of other people like it. So he's still pushing for that. I think he's mentioned that the car's still not quite how he'd like it.
I think one thing that's emphatically not there anymore is the old Schumacher air of mystery, the superior being kind of figure that he used to be.
No.
You know, it's like Tiger Woods this weekend in the Masters at the golf. Yep. You know, he's going to be, I think his previous aura has been shot to pieces.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, that's what people have been saying about Tiger for months, that even if he comes back and even if he's, again, brilliant, which he almost certainly will be, still the perception of him among his rivals will never be quite the same again. They will never... They will, because he had this sort of unearthly quality, and now they said he has normal fragilities. It changes the perception altogether.
Well, sorry, Nigel? Normal fragilities?
Well, I think I'm trying to be...
No, I just thought it was rather a good phrase. I mean,
but I think the other thing, too, you've got to remember with Michael is he's... I mean, everybody said, you know, before he came back, well, he's got a target on his back, you know, which is true, although at the moment probably not particularly necessary. I think he's come back to... He's competing against a lot of guys he's never competed against before.
Yeah.
The overall quality is very, very high at the moment. Higher than for many, many years. And a lot of kids half his age, and the last thing in the world they are is, overawed by Michael Schumacher.
Well, yeah, we saw it with when he passed Lucas Degrassi in Australia. Yeah, absolutely. And Degrassi went straight past him in the next corner.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
no, it's true.
He was in a Virgin car. It's...
And also, you know, I mean, there he was, spent most of the afternoon, you know, behind Al Ghoshari.
Yeah.
And you just think, well, all right, we know about the difficulties of overtaking, but still you think the Schumacher of old would simply have muscled his way past.
I think it's also interesting that one of the skills of being very good at something is knowing when to stop doing it. And in my humble opinion, he should have stopped doing it, which he did, and he shouldn't have come back. The quickest car on the grid, somebody just mentioned, what wasn't the quickest car on the grid, what is the quickest car on the grid, is the Red Bull, Adrian Newey's Red Bull with the Renault engine. It's very, very impressive. It also has what we call normal fragilities, I think. But it won in Malaysia. Nigel, it's looking good for Vettel, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely it is. I mean, it was... You would have to say... I know Braun won the championship last year, but still you would have to say the Red Bull was, without any question, you know, the car of the year, the fastest car of the year. Again, even last year, I mean, it's the Red Bull's abiding problem was lack of reliability. Yeah. Some of it the team, some of it Renault's. And Vettel had this problem with, you know, having to sort of almost miss sessions just around at the very end and so as not to put more miles on the engine because he had so few engines left and so on. But I think thing about this year's car is, you know, it isn't a start-again job. It's an evolution of last year's car. And actually, on that basis, you might have expected it to have been more reliable than it has.
Absolutely, you would.
But not that, you know, notwithstanding. When I, just before Christmas, had lunch with Brundle, and we were talking through last season and the season to come. And Martin said at one point, we were talking about which drivers you would want, and Martin just said, well, we're really talking about three, aren't we? We're talking about Alonso, Hamilton, Vettel. Sure. And I think that is pretty much the case.
Webber's got a problem, hasn't he?
Huh?
Webber's got a problem at the moment.
Seems to have. I mean, the thing about Mark is, you know, Mark is as hard a racer as you'll ever find.
Yeah.
But what he did in Sepang at the first corner was... I mean, I know he thought he was further ahead of Sebastian than he was. But really, you know, he'd got to the first corner first. He really had no need to worry about taking the perfect line into it, because nobody was going to... You know, nobody was going to go by him.
Very strange.
Yeah. And you saw him in the press conference afterwards, and it looked as though he'd actually finished out of the points.
Absolutely. It was on the back of. It was only a week after Melbourne, of course, which obviously means more to him than any other race. And you know, we don't know he will be at Red Bull next year. This year's Melbourne might have been his last opportunity ever to win it.
I reckon so.
Mark is blindingly quick, but he's not Sebastian Vettel. I think very few people are, but I think there's a sort of maybe a bit of tenseness in his driving at the moment. He's almost trying too hard. And having said that, you know, he'll win races.
He's a tough nut.
I'm sure he'll
find the confidence within himself to bounce back from this.
Yeah.
But he's got to be rattled at the moment, I think.
Yeah.
He's got to be affected by
it. I honestly think anybody in a team with Vettel would be.
We've actually had a question in talking about Kubica at Renault and his performances so far this year. And if he carries on driving like this, whether, you know, one of the big teams is going to snap him up. And I can't remember who asked the question, but he said, you know, is Webber at Red Bull a possibility?
Yeah, this question comes from Andy Gearing, who comes from Kent in England, and that's exactly what he does ask. Nigel, I know you're a big fan of Kubica.
Yes, I am. Sorry. Forgive me, I thought you were reading it from there.
No.
I thought you were reading the letter.
No, it's just that I know.
I'm a huge fan of Kubica. I don't think life is easy for a team for which Robert drives, because he is pretty merciless. He's sort of endless push. But, you know, Michael was like that in the Ferrari days. And I think, as I say, you know, it is a matter of fact that the driver, Lewis privately, says he fears more than any other is Kubica. The idea of Kubica in a Red Bull or a Ferrari, which is the other rumour, go to Ferrari, imagine that, Kubica and Alonso.
Be good.
Strongish team.
I'm not saying Massa deserves to be replaced, but if next year they took Kubica, you imagine Alonso and Kubica in the same team.
Jesus.
I mean, apparently they're very good friends.
They're very good friends, yes.
At the moment.
They play poker together all the time. They're very close friends.
Mm.
But okay. if Domenicali could make that work, you know, hats off.
This is possibly the moment to remind everybody that Vettel was my tip for the World Championship this year. Perhaps we should take a look now briefly at some of the new teams. I did ask the question at the beginning of the program. You know, do some of these teams deserve a place on the grid? I was not implying they didn't. Damien, what's your impression of how the new teams are faring?
I think overall not bad, actually, given you know, the ridiculous situation in Bahrain with the Hispania team, unfortunately named HRT team, you know, turning up and having a second car only ready, you know, just in time for the race, etc. I think they're clearly, you know, they've got a lot of work to do on pace. I think that the biggest story for me has been the Virgin embarrassment. with the fuel tank. I had an interesting, overheard an interesting conversation on the train home the other day. And there were some schoolboys talking about Formula One. And it's that little thing about a little bit of knowledge being quite dangerous. And they knew, you know, a fair bit about Formula One and what was going on. But they said, their comment was, what was Richard Branson thinking? You know, he's the guy responsible for this mistake. And he must be absolutely fuming about this, because it's just a fundamental mistake.
It is fairly fundamental, really, yes. Yeah. To be able to carry enough fuel to get to the end of the race. Yeah. Yes, you would think so.
And Branson hasn't got where he's got accepting that kind of mistake.
No,
so I'd be intrigued to know, you know, that what that meeting was like between him and Nick Worth when Nick had to explain to him what happened.
Quite lively.
Yes, I should imagine.
No, it is an unfathomable mistake. There's no doubting that.
And I feel sorry for the team, because the car seems to be a pretty good car in terms of pace. It seems to be, I'd probably say, the quickest of the three so far.
I mean, I don't know. The Lotus is
it's nip and tuck, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is.
I think it's interesting.
I confess, sorry. I hadn't expected them to be quite as many seconds away as they are. And I mean, I must say, Bahrain was an extreme example, I grant you, but it kind of reminded me of the long ago non-championship races when they didn't have enough Grand Prix cars and they used to pad them out with Formula 5000. And so you get sort of Julons in the same race as Ferraris. Yeah. And it really did seem like two completely different races, two different classes. I don't really know what to say about it. I mean, I must say, allowing Chantok out on the track for the first time at the beginning of qualifying, I found absolutely extraordinary. I mean, we live in this age preoccupied with, you know,
health and safety.
Health and safety, and I found that simply extraordinary.
It's preposterous, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know,
and that's no reflection on him.
No,
I mean, he's a very competent driver.
He's a very competent driver. No, but I mean, it was just talk about asking a lot of the guy.
Bizarre.
So, I mean, when I was a kid, there always used to be... I go to the Formula One races with my old man, and there were always, there'd be the sort of the Mosses and the Fangios and the Bearers at the front, and the pack, at the back of the pack, there would always be a sort of gaggle of fairly sort of, you know, raggedy Connaughts and old 250Fs and that sort of thing. And it, I must say, kind of, you know, brought that back to mind a bit.
Has Lotus struck you as being Lotus?
More than I expected. Mm-hmm. More than I expected. And actually, in Bahrain, you know, all the former world champions were there, and Andretti actually spent quite a lot of time with them over the weekend. And he said that they are very keen to be absolutely respectful to the name and legend of Lotus.
Yeah, I mean,
and I like the fact the cars are, you know, the colours they are, and I like the fact they invited Tony Fernandez invited Peter Waugh to the first race. Fernandez strikes me as a very impressive guy.
One of the stories I quite liked was that Clive Chapman has promised Tony Fernandez his father's cap when they have their first win, which I think is quite nice, just because it's sort of an acceptance from the Chapman family.
And
I think that was quite good.
Not much chance of that cap coming out for some time.
No, but for a while.
It's still a very nice.
That's probably why he offered it.
Could be a while. But they have got two.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quick, very experienced drivers. And I mean, if the budget continues as it does at the moment, I mean, you know, and Mike Gascoigne as well, sort of, you know, certainly will drive things along.
Okay.
So, what they're talking of is in terms of, you know, getting on terms with, I don't know, Toro Rosso or whatever. And I don't think that's unrealistic.
No. It's certainly a reminder, isn't it? Am I right that, you know, it just shows you how incredibly difficult it is to do Formula One racing these days. Never mind winning it, just taking part in it is an absolutely monumental task, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it is. It is. And I mean, and everybody's talked about, oh, well, Cosworth, you know, but, you know, Williams are using Cosworth.
Sure. Mm.
And, you know, they haven't achieved very much so far, but I mean, you know, but they've been quick at times.
Yeah.
And in Bahrain, I talked to Rubens about the engine, and he just said the what it lacks at the moment is user friendliness, you know, drivability. But on horsepower, he was pretty happy with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talking of Williams, I haven't been that impressed by Hülkenberg so far this season. I mean, he was touted as, you know, one of the great stars coming into the season.
Well, he was actually touted as the new Michael Schumacher.
I think he's been quite unlucky. I mean, I think, you know, to be bundled out of Melbourne as he was, you know, by Kobayashi on the opening lap.
Yeah. Qualified fifth in Malaysia.
He looked pretty good all the way through in Malaysia, in the, you know, certainly in qualifying. But this is a bit of a Williams phenomenon, and has been for a while now. I mean, you look at the number of races when Nico was there, number of times they would qualify exceptionally well, and they'd be very often fastest of all on Fridays and that sort of thing, and then come the race, it all fades away.
Yeah.
And that still seems to be the same.
I first met him in A1GP, and much lower level than Formula One. He was on the way up at the time, making his name. Had Willy Weber as his manager, just like Michael. And he created a little aura around himself that he was the man to beat, and that the guy who was almost untouchable at times in A1. And I think he carried it through to GP2. And I think still give him time at Williams. I think they'll like him at Williams. And I think he'll come good.
Yeah, I think he will.
Okay, well, we're just over halfway through today's podcast, and I think we'll move on to something slightly different just for a moment, because there is other motor racing going on. We've seen World Rally, where Kimi Raikkonen, much speculation as to how Kimi was going to go, and I think he's finding it as difficult as, say, Virgin is to go Formula One. I mean, it's a whole new learning curve. Certainly the British motor racing season is underway. The British Touring Car Championship is underway. Overall, it seems, Damien, that motor racing has somehow managed to survive and almost thrive, despite all the pressures that are mounting up against it in the world.
As always, Rob, as always, it always seems to manage to find its way. I think the BTCC has lost manufacturers, we all know about that, but Honda and Chevrolet have made commitments to the series. Alan Gow, as usual, is talking up the series, talking about big, decent-sized grids, which it does have. You know, the quality of the drivers isn't there compared to previous years, there's no doubt about it. But it's still the premier British series, still entertains people hugely on TV and at the circuits. And I think actually finding its way as a place for privateers is probably the way forward for the series anyway. That it doesn't need nine manufacturer teams like it used to have in the mid-90s. It's reinvented itself since then. Forget those super touring days. That's gone. And we should really just move on from that. And I think it's taken a long time for the series to get away from the shadow of those 1990s. Yeah. But I think what it's got these days is a very... You know, to use the sort of marketing terminology, it's a good product, and it still entertains people hugely.
Something else we should mention, and I know Nigel watched this race. It was the first IndyCar race in Brazil, in downtown Sao Paulo.
Hmm.
I think that for me, that sort of whetted the appetite for another year of racing.
It was an interesting track surface, wasn't it?
Yes.
And often see a car lose it in a straight line in the dry.
No, it looked a bit like the roads around my village, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it was... Well, I mean, oddly enough, I mean, I saw that. Well, I think that was the same weekend as Bahrain, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, because I saw it when I got back, and I've got to say, I mean, it was vastly more entertaining than the festivities I'd left in the Middle East. But yeah, I mean, it's you can't say IndyCar racing is in a strong state.
No,
And I will always be, you know, misty-eyed about... We were talking about... I mean, Damien just now talking about the BTCC in the 90s. And, I remember CART in the 90s, and that was, as far as I was concerned, that was the best motor racing on Earth, full stop. And the cars looked glorious, they sounded glorious, and there were some wonderful drivers. So it's a little bit difficult to get, excited about a spec formula, which is, in effect, what it is.
Sure.
And I confess, I mean, I you know, quite often I will, particularly at the start of a new season, I look at the I'll put the first race on and look at the grid, and there are names in there of whom I have literally never heard.
No, sure.
And you sort of think, this is quite a ways from the, you know, the answers and Gordon Johncock and AJ Foyt and Rick Mears.
Yep. And Sao Paulo is quite a long way from Indianapolis.
Well, yeah. I mean, nothing wrong with a street race in Sao Paulo. I mean, it was. You know, can't say it wasn't entertaining.
No,
But I just think, sadly, I think, you know, IndyCar racing will never ever be again what it was. You know, and Tony George splintering it apart in the mid-90s, I mean, that was...
Unforgivable.
And also extraordinarily short-sighted from his own point of view.
Yeah. Now, I'm risking the wrath of our US editor, Gordon Kirby, by saying this, but I'm not completely offended by the Dallaras in IndyCar. I don't think they're as bad as they're made out to be by a lot of people. But what do you think about them going radical for the future, Nigel, with this, you know, the Delta Wing project is one of the ideas. Lola have come up with an idea. Swift have come up with an idea.
Well, I mean, I can see at the moment they're looking at all ideas. I mean, I confess the Delta Wing project. I mean, I've looked at it, and when I was at Daytona, I was Chip Ganassi was a huge supporter of it. Gave me a pep talk about it and was very terribly enthusiastic. And sort of talking about, you know, got to think outside the box and everything else. And okay, there's not necessarily anything wrong with thinking outside the box, but I confess, I look at it and think, I just can't imagine 33 of those things coming down the front straight at Indianapolis.
But
they don't look to me like racing cars.
Yeah. But is it sort of a slightly case of, you know, when you, a road car company brings out a concept, it's always way beyond what you'll ever see that actually, you know, so some of the ideas will be carried forward, but actually when it comes to the, you know, the car getting to the track, it's not going to look anything as extreme as that.
It maybe not, but I mean, I still remember being at the launch of the six-wheel Tyrrell and thinking, oh, God, that is so hideous. I know Patrick Depailler adored it and thought it was sensational to drive and everything else. And it was not a problem in as far as it was like the Lotus Turbine car. As long as it was a one-off, as long as it was different, that was fine. But I always thought it was about the ugliest thing I ever saw on a racetrack. And then people started experimenting with six wheels, with four wheels at the back.
Williams.
And I thought, was back to the Pat Clancy special at Indianapolis in the late 40s, which mercifully died a death. And so this whole thing, sorry, I'm digressing, but going back to this Delta Wing thing, when I first saw it, I mean, I immediately thought of a six-wheel Tyrrell. And I don't find it attractive to look at, I'm afraid.
I think if you want to be radical, then ask Gordon Murray to design it, would be my view. Anyway, the point of what I was going round the table and going round the world at the beginning of the season is really to make the point that, you know, there's lots of motor racing to watch. Some of it is very exciting and very, very interesting, particularly, I think, in America, actually. And we haven't even got on to GP, MotoGP yet, but we will in our next podcast. I think we should take a couple of questions from our loyal readers and listeners. There's one here from Frédéric Weisser in France, who talks about Patrick Tambay, Nigel.
Mm-hmm.
This is a result of reading Lunch with Derek Warwick in Motorsport magazine. And he makes the point that Tombay's hardly known at all in France, which I hadn't really I'd thought about before, but it's true. What are your memories of Tombay as a driver? It was a difficult career.
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say, I mean, he's without any question one of the nicest blokes I've ever met in motor racing, or indeed in life. Just a delightful guy, just a, you know, wonderful character, great sense of humour. Of course, it didn't hurt that he's a huge Anglophile. His English is perfect. He, you know, he could impersonate several drivers in English. I mean, that's how good his English is. Just a lovely bloke. As a driver, he was people. I remember somebody once describing him as a sort of lesser Chris Amon. And there is probably some truth in that, in the sense that they were both... I mean, Tombay was never as good as Amon, but he had a lot of natural talent.
Yeah.
And I think what Tombay lacked to a degree and Amon lacked to a degree was... in effect, their personalities worked against them. They were almost too nice guys to be Grand Prix drivers. But when Patrick was really on it, I mean, he was pretty spectacular.
And he's,
Not spectacular in style, but in performance. I mean, he could be very, very quick. But I think he was. I mean, when he was at Ferrari with René Arnoux, who was a, you know, entirely different sort of character, and a, you know, a real sort of, you know,
rough diamond,
unpolished diamond, yes, but a real street fighter as well, and that wasn't really Patrick, but I mean, I Harvey Postlethwaite, when Patrick was a Ferrari, Harvey always said, you know, the whole world underestimates Patrick, underrates him. He's a very, very good driver.
Yeah.
But probably just not, as I say, with the necessary killer instinct.
And then, I mean, he returns to the Goodwood Revival historic meeting in his late 40s, early 50s, and drives a Cobra like he was 19 again.
Right, he drove the Dino 246, didn't he? Yeah.
Fantastic. One of the great beauties, one of the many beauties of Motorsport magazine and being involved with Motorsport magazine, is we can move decades and centuries and talk about the past, the present, and the future. And I'm going to spring one on my editor now. This one comes from Alistair Warren. And he wants to know, Damien Smith, what is the real name for the knee-operated F-duct F-wing, F-channel device that McLaren are running this year? Do any of us know?
I only know it as the F-duct. That's as far as I know.
Me too.
It's called, you know. And I welcome it. It's a typical piece of Formula One innovation.
Absolutely.
To come up with something like that. And I think McLaren upset people by doing it, but they've just been clever, I think.
And now they'll all have to have it.
And then the FIA will close off the F duct in some way, and it'll be outlawed. But that's what Formula One's all about, and always should be, as far as I can see.
Well, I think it's a good...
I'm actually quite interested that Adrian is a little bit chary. Adrian Newey is a little bit chary of it from a safety standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah. In terms of, because it in fact stalls the rear wing, and you know, Adrian thinks deeply, and he doesn't. You know, he doesn't make comments sort of
left, right, and centre.
No. So I thought it was quite significant that is a thought that's occurred to him, because I haven't heard anybody say that.
And well, I love all this, you know, speculation about Newey and active ride, and you know, how they're managing to get the right height.
One of the great beauties of being a motorsport reader, of course, is that you can occasionally catch out the panel. So well done, Alistair Warren. The fact is, we don't know, but I think there's a lot of F's in here, so it might be interesting to know what the other teams call it.
I know what the other teams call CFD, but unfortunately I can't say it on the...
Can you not? How disappointing.
Oh dear. Well, somebody called the first word was complete and the last word was disaster.
Ah, yes. Yes, that's CFD, yes. Which is computer design, of course.
Yes.
Okay, yes. Yes, I think we've got the middle word. Ed Foster, you've been on your travels, and I want you to tell us very briefly about them, because they're going to appear in the Next magazine, and I know people look forward to the Next magazine. And one thing in particular you did was go to the Wolfgang von Trips Museum, which is something I think many of us would like to do, both in here and out there.
Yeah, I mean, I set off in the Lotus Elise, the Motorsport Lotus Elise, and for a German trip. And took in Wolfsburg, the Volkswagen Museums, Hanover, the Volkswagen Motorsport Facility, von Trips Museum, as you mentioned, and other bits and pieces. So they'll be appearing in the magazine in the future. But the von Trips Museum, it's actually, so the story behind it is very interesting, because the family, after Wolfgang died, sort of fell into financial trouble and had to sell the family Schloss and move to this house next door to it. And in there, this sort of museum, which is being run by a foundation, has sort of emerged. And the problem is, I don't think they've got enough money to actually exhibit the stuff properly. But it's all there. And it's, at the moment, it just looks like a bit of a... Not a junk shop is too harsh a phrase, but it's an amazing sort of weird collection of memorabilia and lots of his own personal belongings. A lot of it is quite strange, but other bits are very interesting. So... It's worth a visit, but I think it's only open on Sundays because of financial problems and staffing it. But I'll tell you more in the magazine in the future.
Great. Well, one of my boyhood heroes. I don't know about you, Nigel.
Trips. Yes. Yeah.
Von Trips. That's what racing drivers should be like, I think. We'll take one last question. It comes from Mike Holland, and it returns us to Schumacher. Well, sorry, but it does. And Mike Holland is asking, Damien, whether perhaps the team should have Michael as a mentor, advisor, consultant to Nico Rosberg and not as a teammate.
I'm sure he'd be delighted.
Yeah, he'd love that.
To do that.
Put that to Faber. I think he'd love that idea.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's a good idea at the moment. I think let's see how Michael can get on as a racing driver again. In the future... You know, he played a mentor kind of role to Massa in the last year of Ferrari, which to me was quite surprising to see that relationship develop, because Michael was never one for giving to his teammates, and he did take a sort of a slightly paternal view of Massa in that final year, as if he'd already he knew deep down that this was the end of his career was coming up, and he did actually care about what came after. Whether he'd take the same view of Mercedes, I don't really know how that relationship between Nico and Michael is developing, or if it's developing at all. But I don't think Nico needs mentoring, to be honest. I think he's a Grand Prix driver in his own right. He's been doing it since 2006 now, so he's got a few years under his belt. Okay, he hasn't had the wins and the big results, but I think they'll come, and he doesn't need patronising by Michael Schumacher or anyone else.
Well, yes. Hope that answers your question, Mr. Holland. I think it does. Nigel, briefly, or Schumacher as a consultant?
Well, I can't imagine. I certainly can't imagine him, you know, mentoring anybody while he's still competing.
Well, no.
And trying to beat them, because you know, I mean, your teammate might be your best friend, but he's still your worst enemy.
Sure.
So I can't see that happening. The other thing that strikes me is, you know, when Michael was coming to the races with Ferrari after he'd retired, he just looked like a lost soul.
He did.
Most of the time. He was normally, you know, quite sort of clipped and curt and bad-tempered.
Yeah.
And he just didn't seem as though he wanted to be there in that capacity. It was almost as he, you know, he couldn't stay away, but on the other hand, when he was there, he just wasn't enjoying it. So it's hard to see Michael just sort of, you know, being a mentor for anybody. And Damien's right, you know, Nico doesn't need him.
Okay, well, we're nearly at the end of our time, but I'd like to just quickly go round round the table and look forward to the season coming up, and having had three races to study. Ed Foster, how do you think this is going to play out now that we've got over all the excitement of it being the best thing ever and the best season in, you know?
Well, I think anyone would be stupid to ignore the Red Bulls, and, you know, if their reliability doesn't plague them for the rest of the season, then Vettel is going to be very hard to beat, because the other teams will catch up, you know, they always do, but whether they can do that fast enough, I don't know. I mean, you know, we saw in you know, qualifying this year how quick the Red Bulls really are, and last race in Malaysia it looked as though they were racing and they still had more to give, you know, they were driving 99%, but if anyone's going to catch them, I'd put money on Alonso and maybe Hamilton, but I suggest Vettel. As though I hate to agree with you, Rob. I think you made a good call there with that prediction.
Mr. Roebuck.
Yeah, I agree with what Ed says. I think, and just going back to what I was saying earlier on about, you know, Brundle's remark towards the end of last year, you know, ideally you want Vettel, Alonso or Hamilton, don't you? I actually, on talent, would put Kubica into that too. I would pick a top four on talent, but in terms of what they've got at the moment, yeah, I can see Fernando and Lewis. If anybody is going to challenge Vettel over the season, I can see it. I would expect it to be those two.
Damien?
Yes, well, I'm looking forward to seeing Alonso and Hamilton putting in those performances we've seen so far. I mean, Hamilton, he pushes the boundaries at every stage. I mean, his weaving down the straight at Malaysia was completely out of order, really. It went way too far. I was glad that he didn't get penalised for it, because Petrov wasn't trying to overtake him. He was just trying to, you know, break the toe. But he'll always do that. He'll always push things to the limit. And I like that about Lewis Hamilton. So we'll see more of that, more of Fernando Alonso doing supreme things in Ferraris. But, yeah, the man to beat is Sebastian at the moment. So I just hope that he doesn't get on a run and score a run of victories and break the back of the championship. Because this point system, I'm still trying to get my head around it, really, how it's going to play out. Because it's kept things very tight.
It's looking pretty good at the moment.
Yeah.
So would it be fair to say you all agree with me?
About what?
The Vettel's going to be the world champion.
No, I'd still say Alonso.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with Alonso as well. But you're probably right.
Okay.
On that note.
No, I love Damien's enthusiasm for Lewis Hamilton, because I share it absolutely. I mean, you know, thank God for entertainment. He's a fantastic driver. One of the stewards at Sepang, of course, was Johnny Herbert, and I can't imagine Johnny Herbert wanting to penalise that particular instance.
Well, Johnny, being the bloke he is, would have just seen it as over-enthusiasm, I suspect, and the warning that he got, I think, was exactly the right...
Yeah, I think if he'd done it lap after lap,
yeah,
it would have been a different thing.
Yeah,
I think it was a sort of instinctive thing, and I'm reacting to this situation, you know, as it happens. I thought at the time, oof, that's marginal. That's marginal. And in Petrov, in fact, I mean, Petrov certainly did have designs on passing, didn't he? And got to the corner and he, you know.
He's actually had a good season.
Absolutely. Yeah. But In terms of good things about this season, one of the things I really like is that Tott has completely revamped the way the stewards behave. Mm. And also, you know, Max's 2IC has been removed from the equation. And now we have a Prost was in Bahrain acting as the steward, you know, the first race, for instance. So that's an excellent idea.
But what's been...
To have a Grand Prix driver who knows advising the stewards, that's, you can't put a price on that.
And what's been quite telling since Tott took over is that the racing has been in the headlines. And it's just been the racing. And admittedly, it's been either boring or exciting, but it's... That's what's in the not political goings on.
I think we're, are we not? We're all surprised at how pleased we are with Monsieur Tott at the FIA thus far.
No question about it. Yeah. And we haven't had, you know, I mean, we got to the ridiculous point, hadn't we, where there was sort of like four or five penalties a race, and it was just getting so nanny-fied, it was absurd. And I think it's interesting that in the year when NASCAR have gone back and sort of said, okay, boys, bump drafting is fine. Just do your own thing. Just don't do anything sort of really silly. And it's helped. It's certainly helped in NASCAR. Yeah. And in a way, it seems to be a little bit like that in F1 too, because, you know, we've gone through three races now without anybody being sort of, you know,
Rejoice, pulled over the coals.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And Lewis's petulance surfacing every now and again is always going to keep us entertained as well. Cause,
well, you know, yes.
It's.
I think he's... Probably, I can see Whitmarsh eventually getting a little tired of, you know...
Very public outbursts.
Not before long, I'd say.
Freaking stupid decisions over the radio when I'm supposed to be trying to drive a race.
Yeah.
But, you know, the button Hamilton thing fascinates me because in so many ways it reminds me of Senna and Prost.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. Yes, very, very interesting year ahead. Let us end with our traditional summary of what is in the latest motorsport magazine, because I would urge you to buy one. It's good stuff. Damien, just give us a...
Yeah, hopefully you might have seen it already by now. My issue's been on sale for a little while. But it's our celebration of 60 years of the Formula One World Championship. So... Founded in May 1950 at Silverstone, so we took this opportunity to celebrate decade by decade six of the best writers tackling the decade. So Doug Nye in the 50s, Ian Young in the 60s, Alan Henry in the 70s, Nigel on the 80s, Maurice Hamilton on the 90s, and Adam Cooper on the noughties. So we really enjoyed putting this one together, so hopefully everyone will enjoy reading it.
60 years of Formula One, go and get it. It's a good magazine. And lunch with...
Lunch with is Ricardo Patrese this month, which we thought was quite fitting, given that until Rubens beat his record, he was the most, you know, the most starts of any Grand Prix driver. Real Italian gent. You know, Nigel always had a lot of time for Ricardo.
Yeah, yeah.
Simon had a great time with him out in Italy, and you know, lovely guy. Yeah. Mm.
Okay, that's what's in your motorsport magazine. Well, we are off now to have a general election in Great Britain, in case you hadn't heard. So when we return, we will try not to have too many acronyms or acrimony, which is going to fill the whole of the next month, I've got a feeling. Anyway, we'll be back at the beginning of the month of May, the month of Indianapolis, of course. We hope to have a guest with us then, and if we are going to have a guest, we will certainly let you know on the website who that guest is going to be. But for now, my great thanks to our editor Damien, to Nigel, and to Ed, and to Al, who looks after the quality of this recording. Probably some radiator in it this week, yes? Yeah, some radiator noises, but anyway, it's motor racing. See you next time, bye.
Motorsport Magazine, the audio podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.